This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to some of Terry's recent conversation with comedian Louis C.K. He was just named Comic Genius of the Year by GQ, and Time magazine recently called his FX series Louis the best TV show of the year, saying, "It's a show about everything. Death, war, divorce, masturbation, parenting, unrequited love, an R-rated, painfully funny meditation on life as something ridiculous, terrible, and beautiful." Louis C.K. created the series, writes and directs it, and stars as a comic named Louis, who, like C.K., is a divorced father of two young girls. Louis C.K. has a new stand-up comedy special, but you won't see it on HBO or Comedy Central. It's only available from Louis C.K.'s website. A video download of the show went on sale at noon on Saturday, December 10th. Louis C.K. posted on his website that 12 hours later, more than 50,000 copies had been sold. Let's start with an excerpt from that new special. Here, C.K. is talking about how his recent success has allowed him to fly first class. That means he boards the plane first and gets to watch tired and frustrated passengers, including soldiers on their way to war, slowly board and squeeze into their seats in coach.
I see soldiers fly all the time because that's how they get to the war. You think they get to go in a cool green plane with a red light and go, go, go? No, they just go to Delta and they just wait in line to go to a war. And they always fly coach. I've never seen a soldier in first class in my life. It could be a full bird colonel. He's between two fat guys in coach. And they're always nice. I've never seen a soldier get on a plane like, "Hey, I'm in the army. F*** you. I have a gun." They're always like, "Oh, yes, sir. Thank you very much, ma'am." It's like having an extra flight attendant. They help everybody put their shit up. They're awesome. And every time that I see a soldier on a plane, I always think, you know what? I should give him my seat. It would be the right thing to do. It would be easy to do, and it would mean a lot to him. I could go up to him, "Hey, son." I get to call him son. "Hey, son, go ahead and take my seat." Because I'm in first class. Why? For being a professional ass. This guy is giving his life for the country, he thinks, and so he has to sit. But that's good enough. That's good enough. The fact that he thinks it. I'm serious. He's told by everybody in his life system that that's a great thing to do, and he's doing it. And it's scary, but he's doing it, and he's sitting in this seat, and I should trade with him. I never have. Let me make that clear. I've never done it once. I've had so many opportunities. I never even really seriously came close. And here's the worst part. I still just enjoyed the fantasy for myself to enjoy. I was actually proud of myself for having thought of it. I was proud. Oh, I am such a sweet man. That is so nice of me. To think of doing that and then totally never do it.
That's Louis C.K. from his new comedy special, Live at the Beacon Theater, which is on his website. Louis C.K., welcome back to Fresh Air. It is so great to have you back. So with this new comedy special, what you've decided to do is put it on your website and charge $5 as opposed to getting it on a TV network like your HBO comedy specials in the past. So why have you decided to do it this way?
Well, this is my fourth full hour special, and the first two I did for cable, and those were the traditional, that the cable network pays for the production, and they give you a little bit of money, and then it goes on the air, and then they go try to make a profit with it. You're supposed to participate in that profit, but I've never seen a check from a comedy special. It never ends up being that. And then the third one I did was called Hilarious, and I shot it as a movie. Like, I self-produced it, although Comedy Central paid for that one. They paid for this to produce it as a movie and have it go into theaters and then onto Comedy Central. And that was sort of an experiment. And then this time, I don't know, I just thought this might be interesting to give this a try. Put it on my website, make it $5, make it really, really easy for people to watch and to buy and to enjoy, to make it as close to a viral video as possible.
So your second season of your FX series, Louis, was fantastic. And I assume it'll
be
on DVD sometime soon, so viewers will get it a second chance to see it if they missed it. And
yes.
this season, it was so much about the lives of comics. I just found that theme so fascinating. So I want to play a couple of examples. One of them deals with Dane Cook, who's, as most people know, a very famous comic, super successful. And in this episode, you're still playing clubs. He's super successful. Your daughter really wants tickets to a Lady Gaga concert. And you know that Dane Cook knows her. He's toured with her. So you want to approach him for tickets. But it's kind of awkward because there's been this whole controversy where he's been accused of stealing a couple of your jokes. So you're in a really awkward spot. So you're meeting with him, and this excerpt starts with Dane Cook talking.
2006. That should have been like my triumph. And I enjoyed it, Louis, for maybe 2 months. 2 months before it started to suck, because everything I read about me was about how I stole jokes from you, which I didn't.
I kind of think you did.
Dude, why would I steal 3 jokes from you when I have hours of material? Why? Why would I do that? Risk my reputation?
Because they were funny jokes.
You know what, Louis? You know what the biggest lie in the world is? That I'm a rock star, I'm a millionaire, I'm a comedy behemoth, and you're like a comics comic, and you're an inside joke guy, and I'm a sellout, and I sold my soul, and you have artistic integrity, and you're a good guy. We're in this room right now, you and me. You looking at me. You let your name be used to hurt me. And now you're sitting here asking me to use my fame to get you tickets to Lady Gaga? I mean, how do you feel right now?
Very.
So you admit that this is all bull.
I want to know what I think. I don't think that you saw me do those jokes and said, I'm going to tell those jokes too. I don't think there's a world where you're that stupid or that bad a guy. I do think, though, that you're like a machine of success. You're like a rocket, and you're rocketing to the stars, and your engines are sucking stuff up. Stuff is getting sucked up in your engines, like birds and bugs and some of my jokes. I think you saw me do them. I know you saw me do them, and I think they just went in your brain. And I don't think you meant to do it, but I don't think you stopped yourself either. And that's why I never felt the need to help you not be hated by a lot of people.
Okay, this is Louis C.K. and Dane Cook in an episode of season 2 of Louis C.K.'s series, Louis. So this is based on a real incident. What made you think of actually writing it into your series?
Well, what's interesting is that it's not a real, it's an incident that never happened. He and I never had that meeting.
But he was accused of stealing your jokes.
That's right. Yeah, he was. And we were on these two sides of this crazy thing. It was like one of the first YouTube grudges matches, you know, where people would post his joke and my joke. And then everyone would comment who they thought stole what. And, you know, but I always had very ambivalent feelings about it because he's a human being. And I always felt a little weird about the whole thing. You know, I felt like I felt what you just heard me say. But I didn't. A lot of people just said he's a horrible thief, and he was so vilified that it was really hard to watch happen. But anyway, I don't know. I started to think about him as I was writing season 2, and I thought it would be interesting to have us talk about it. So I sat down and I thought about the things I've read him say in the press and heard him say, and I thought I channeled him. Like I thought, if I can make him the sort of the winner of the debate, or at least an even match, then it's worth doing. Letting him call me a fraud was really fun. It's so much more interesting than, like, I could have made him a straw dog or had somebody play him and gotten off on myself by saying you stole from me. But it was way more fun to have to go into someone who stole from me supposedly and have him call me a fraud. It's just so interesting. So I wrote it up and I wrote Dane an email and said, I wrote something. Do you want to read it with me? And he came to my office and we read it out loud together. And he said, I'll do this. And he all went all in. I wrote that exact verbatim. He read everything the way I wrote it. And he asked for a couple of changes, and I said, no.
What did he ask for?
He wanted to be lighter. He wanted to be less angry. He said, I'm not angry about this anymore, and I don't want to represent myself that way. And I said, well, the way you want to represent yourself isn't my lookout. I want to tell a story that's dramatic and interesting. And he saw that as valuable and said, sure, okay. So he kind of, I think he kind of went back in time a little to get that anger up. And probably he's got some little residual anger, and I had some residual anger. So we both got to sort of say our thing. And then it was unresolved. That was the important thing to me, is that we said both of our things, and then it sort of lay there between us and didn't really go anywhere.
I want to talk about another episode from season two. And, you know, there were several episodes that dealt with comedians. And this one is about a comic who you hadn't seen in many years. And he shows up, and he's broke. He's living in his car. He doesn't have work. And he's really crude on stage, but he's really crude and rude off stage to people too. And he's actually really embarrassing you because he has no social skills at all. And so you're driving with him like late at night after your show, and he basically tells you. Then you stop and get out and talk and walk. And he tells you basically that he wants to kill himself, and that his doctor gave him some pills and told him not to take too many of them because it could kill him. And he interpreted that as the doctor saying, you know, I know you want to kill yourself. You should kill yourself. Here are some pills that will help you do it. Mm-hmm. So he's just kind of laid this on you, that he wants to kill himself and that he plans on doing it at his next stop. And you have to decide how to react. So here's an excerpt of that scene.
Why are you here telling me this right now?
You know, I don't know. I just wanted to say goodbye to someone. Well, if I leave a note, it's just going to get burned with my clothes. So I figured you for the one guy that I could say adios to.
Eddie, this is bull. You can't kill yourself.
Oh, yes, I can. I have a note from a doctor.
I don't give a what that guy said. You can't do that.
And why can't I do that?
Because...
Louis, look me in the eye and tell me I have one good reason to live.
No.
See, you got nothing.
No. No, I'm not playing that. I'm not doing it.
What do you mean?
I mean, f- you, man. I got my reasons to live. I worked hard to figure out what they are. I'm not just handing them to you. Okay? You want a reason to live, have a drink of water and get some sleep. Wake up in the morning and try again like everybody else
does.
Yeah,
I get it. Yeah, tough love.
No love. Okay, more like tough, not giving a shit anymore, Eddie. If you want to tap out because your life is shit, you know what? It's not your life. It's life. It's life is bigger than you. It's, if you can imagine that, life isn't something that you possess. It's something that you take part in and you witness.
You are so excited right now that you get to give the big speech. You would love to be the guy that talks this loser who you never think about out of suicide so you can feel better about yourself.
That's my guest Louis C.K. and Doug Stanhope in an episode of Louis C.K.'s FX series. Louis, have you been in that position where somebody's told you that they want to kill themselves and you have to decide what are you supposed to do with that?
Well, it's a scary thing to ponder, you know, but it's emotional to hear that clip now because, I mean, I wrote that about a lot of comedians I knew coming up, and comedy and show business are very cruel, and they don't have a nice way of saying no or goodbye, you know, and a lot of guys live really tough lives in this racket, and I've known a lot of them and come up with some of them, and some have made it, some haven't, and, you know, the idea of somebody saying to you, look me in the eye and tell me I have a reason to live, it's terrifying to think, what if I fail them in that moment? And Doug Stanhope is somebody I've known for a lot of years, not well, but I've always known him. We've traveled the same paths, and I love Doug. I have real affection for him. And, you know, he doesn't take very good care of himself, and he, you know, medicates himself in many different ways. And I've always been scared for him. I've always been afraid that he's going to let himself go and die. And
So you send him the script in which he wants to kill himself. How did he react to that?
Well, you know, he's... When I've felt that fear about Doug for a lot of years, and then I look at what he writes on his website and I've listened to him, and I realize that there's something narcissistic in my fear. You know what I mean? Like, he's taking care of himself and he's making his choices as a grown up. And so that was sort of an evolution of thinking for me. But then the reason I guess it's emotional now is because I lost my friend Patrice.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. This is the comic who... Do you want to take a break for a second?
No, it's okay.
Okay, this is the comic
Patrice,
who... You dedicated your special to him, and he...
Yeah, Patrice died of, you know, in a diabetic coma, and he didn't take good care of himself. And there's part of me that is, you know, upset with him for not taking care of himself, you know, because he took himself away from us. So I guess to me it's like, it's funny to hear that now and, you know.
Yeah, well, you wrote that before this happened, so.
Yeah, yeah.
You certainly weren't thinking about his death.
No, not at all. And, you know, it's just funny because I had such a different perspective on that issue of, like, someone's not taking care of themselves. Someone's not keeping themselves safe. And what is your role in that? And the anger I feel towards Doug in that scene is this kind of, is the kind of anger I feel about Patrice now that he's gone. So it's interesting to look back on it because the thing, the place I took myself in that scene, as I was writing it, I didn't know where it was going. I knew I wanted to stand on that street and have him give me that news, and I didn't know where I wanted it to go. So I started writing to him my argument, why not to kill yourself? And as I was writing it, I realized for this argument to succeed would be really gross. For me to, like, be the guy who gives him the reason to live is so self-serving. And that the fact that I was even attempting it on paper, I was embarrassed alone in a room. And so the way that I... The path I found to the truth of the scene for me was having Doug be the one to tell me how full of crap I was for trying it. So in other words, as I was sitting there typing, here's why you shouldn't kill yourself, I stopped and said to myself, oh my God, congratulations, you pig. You know, who do you think you are? And so then I had Doug basically say that. And, you know, Doug is a lot more together than any of the people that I'm asking him to play there. Doug has a real career, and he's a great comedian. He's one of the best. And I didn't know he could act. He's never acted in his life. That's the first thing he ever acted in, really. And I called him, and I said, I wrote this thing. It's kind of an amalgam of a lot of guys, and your voice would sound great doing it. Do you want to do it? And he said, I can't act. He told me right away, I can't do it. And I said, I didn't ask you if you can. What I'm asking is, do you want to? And he said, well, yes, I do want to. And I thought, well, that desire will make it work, you know. The crazy thing is that I was so exhausted when we shot that episode. It was one of the last things we shot. I was so strung out. I didn't know any of my lines. I was depressed. I was just really not in good shape. And Doug came so prepared, and he was the best. I'm going to say he's the best actor I had on the season.
So I want to play one more clip from the second season of Louis. You're playing the lounge at an Atlantic City casino, and you're doing jokes about the lounge and about Donald Trump, who owns the lounge. And the manager says to you, you can't do those jokes. You can't insult Trump. You can't insult the casino. And you decide to take a principal stand and not compromise as a comic, and so you quit. And then you see Joan Rivers, who's playing the main room, and you sit down and you're having a talk with her. And she is just really shocked that you quit. And she thinks that's a really stupid move. So anyways, here you are meeting with her, and she speaks first.
You're in the lounge.
I was.
You were fired?
I quit.
What do you quit? Nobody quits.
I quit.
Are you crazy? Are you a trust fund baby that you quit?
No, it's just that they got upset because I was saying stuff about the casino and I was making fun of Trump. And...
You're in a Trump hotel. You don't make fun of the owner of the hotel. Are you crazy? He's not going to hire a comedian that's going to say, Donald Trump.
I know, but
No, this is not an easy business. I mean, you want to try my life sometimes? I work in Arizona. How about that? And Indian casinos. You think that's easy? You tell a joke they don't like, instead of a tomato, they throw a tomahawk? What do you expect? I mean, you got a job. How lucky are you, for goodness sakes?
Yeah, but come on. You're in the nice theater here. They got me in the lounge.
I was in the lounge, sweetie puss, 2 years ago. For all I know, I'll be back in the lounge 2 years from now. And you'll be in the main room. Things change. That's the business. Look at the perks you're getting. You've got a job. You got a card for the free food in the employee cafeteria. I mean, stop bitching and go buy yourself a pocketbook that's lined in plastic and throw food in when they're not looking.
Yeah, great.
You know what's wrong with you guys? You don't know when you're lucky. appreciate where you are, for God's sakes.
And that's Joan Rivers and Louis C.K. from Louis C.K.'s season two of his FX series, Louis. So what did you think of getting Joan Rivers involved in this episode?
I saw Joan Rivers' movie, A Piece of Work, her documentary. I've always loved Joan Rivers since I was a kid. I've always looked up to her like a big sister or something as a comedian. She's just so good and she tries so hard. And,
looked up to her as a big sister because you knew her or from
no,
afar?
No, just from afar. I remember seeing her like on 60 Minutes when I was a kid, and they showed how hard she worked and how she had this joke database, and she's just obsesses with writing jokes and jokes, and they're all good, and some of them are great. And I just think, and I was raised by a single mom and three sisters in a world of women, so when women succeed, I root for them. Yeah, that's just the way it is for me, and so I've always loved her. And then I saw this documentary, and it just ripped me to pieces. I was very affected, and I thought, if Joan Rivers was sitting next to me telling me these things about survival and appreciation of life, I would want to kiss her right on the lips. That's what I remember thinking when I was watching it. So I thought, that's how I want to make that happen. I want to try to get Joan. I want to write something for her to say that represents the beauty of her, and then I try to make out with her. That's interesting and it's funny. So that's what we did.
So was she immediately on board when you invited her to do this?
Well, we sent it to her, and you know, another thing I learned from the documentary is that she fields every offer. She says no to almost nothing. She just works so hard. So I knew I could get it to her, and you know, and I the show was doing pretty well the first season. So her people put it in front of her and said, you should do this, and she called me. And she said, the script was very different at the time. And she said, you know, what is this? This is preachy. I hate this. She said, I want to do it, but we got to make it funnier. And I was like, oh, brother, I don't want the writing partner, Joan Rivers, here, you know. But she started, she said the thing about the pocket with the plastic lining and a trust fund baby and tomahawks. She started throwing stuff like that just on the phone with me, just saying, well, you know, why not say this? And I'm furiously writing it down, and she made it funnier. And then she showed up and put in a harder day of work than almost anybody I worked with. She just worked so hard. She was great.
Louis C.K. speaking with Terry Gross. C.K.'s new comedy special is called Live at the Beacon Theater. You'll find a much longer version of Terry's conversation with Louis C.K., as well as Terry's 2010 interview with Joan Rivers, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Jazz has long been a staple of European television programming. American musicians on tour frequently turn up on the tube, caught live or in a studio. That's partly because such shows are relatively cheap to produce, and because jazz makes for good cultural programming. A new set of vintage concerts by Americans abroad is now out on 6 DVDs. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead takes a look.
Amazing tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin doing two things he loved, playing at a crazy fast tempo and then quoting a nursery rhyme as if it's all child's play. Griffin was on a festival stage in Provence at the time, wearing a stylish paisley sort of dashiki, stylish for 1971. You can see it for yourself. Two energetic Griffin sets with Art Taylor on drums are in a new box in the Jazz Icons series. 6 DVDs shot for French TV between 1959 and 73, mostly in black and white. John Coltrane headlines the new Jazz Icons DVD release with a 1965 appearance by his classic quartet on the Riviera. If it doesn't seem so explosive, That's partly because Coltrane didn't move much when he played, no matter how passionate the music, and because his mid-60s activities are so extensively documented. But you do get abridged live versions of music from Coltrane's recent albums A Love Supreme and Ascension. For visual thrills, nothing here beats Russ on Roland Kirk's 1972 museum gig. It's fascinating to see the logistics of his playing several horns at the same time. He'll blow three saxes or two flutes at once, or play recorder with his nose and panpipes with his mouth. He'll finger tenor sax with one hand while clamping hi-hat cymbals with the other, or play two saxes while circular breathing so he doesn't have to come up for air. He can sound a little wheezy, like a bagpipe running down, but Rassan gets some wonderful frictive sounds, all the spectacle aside. Some jazz people still detest the 1970s, when electric instruments became common and established stars began or kept on getting funky. But even skeptics might look at trumpeter Freddie Hubbard's 1973 French concert, with George Cables on electric piano and a little boogaloo in the beat. This tough quintet is a perfect setting for the trumpeter's swagger. You have to keep reminding yourself, this stuff was supposed to be destroying jazz. The new Jazz Icons DVDs also include Art Blakey 1959 with Young Lions Lee Morgan on trumpet and Wayne Shorter on saxophone, and Thelonious Monk playing a rare solo piano gig in 1969. Those two are notable not just for the music, but for bonus interview segments shot for French TV. The raw footage of Monk's interview is excruciatingly priceless. The pianist is in a cooperative mood, but the host keeps interrupting him, making him repeat his answers over and over, till he tells his interrogator exactly what he wants to hear. It's a mini Samuel Beckett play. It's always great to see Monk at work, with his idiosyncratic hands-low-to-the-keyboard attack, even if the camera is always pointed elsewhere when he miraculously bends notes on piano, just when you want to study his fingers. That's a quibble. There's plenty of good music in the new Jazz Icons box. Good music to see and hear.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com and the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed the new Jazz Icons DVD box set featuring performances by Art Blakey, John Coltrane, Johnny Griffin, Freddie Hubbard, Rashan Roland Kirk, and Thelonious Monk. You might recognize the voice of our guest John Feinstein from his regular appearances on NPR's Morning Edition. He's one of the nation's leading sports journalists and the author of 28 books. The two best known are Season on the Brink, about his year shadowing the volatile Indiana basketball coach Bobby Knight, and A Good Walk Spoiled, a behind-the-scenes look at the pro golf tour. Feinstein's known for his insight and inside portraits of some of sport's most talented and temperamental characters. And in his new book, he writes about how he got access to these athletes and coaches and about his sometimes stormy relationships with them. The book is called One-on-One: Behind the Scenes with the Greats in the Game. I spoke with John Feinstein earlier this month. Well, John Feinstein, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's talk about some of the people that you covered and experiences. Your first book, was about Bobby Knight, the legendary college basketball coach who is remembered for scowling at people, tossing chairs across the court, and at one point manhandling a player. I mean, a very, very volatile guy. How did you manage to get him to give you total access to write a book about his season? What do you think? Why do you think he took you into his confidence?
I think the reason he did it, Dave, and the irony, because as you know, he hated the book, is that the book did exactly what I think Bob Knight wanted it to do. He wanted an outsider to come in, have the access that I had, and basically report back and say there is a method to the madness. There are reasons why he does this. He's not just crazy. Now, Dave, there are moments when he was just crazy. But there were also moments when I saw a side of him because I was allowed to be up close that you couldn't possibly see without having total access. They lost two straight games at the start of the Big Ten season that year, and he was beside himself. And in the middle of a tape session when he was just berating the players over one misplay after another, all of a sudden he just stopped the tape. And he looked at the players and he said, I tell you all the time you can't be successful as basketball players if you're selfish people. And I'm not just talking about passing the ball or getting back on defense. It's more than that. And he talked about the fact that the players on Thanksgiving had gone to the team doctor's house for Thanksgiving dinner because basketball teams are always on campus during the holidays. He said, now, Mrs. Rink, the doctor's name was Larry Rink, cooked for you guys, cleaned up before you got there, cleaned up after you were there, did everything she could to make a good Thanksgiving for you. Anybody in this room who wrote her a note, sent her flowers, called her on the phone to say thank you, raise your hand. And not a single hand went up. And he said, that's what I'm talking about. You're selfish people. And as long as you're selfish people, you can't be good basketball players. Now, what that told me, Dave, was one, he knew his team. He knew his players. And it was also one of the great teaching moments I've ever seen. It had nothing to do with basketball.
Yeah, you said he got up and stalked out after saying you're all
selfish. And he just walked right out of the room. Just walked out of the room, and I remember one of the assistants, Con Smith, looking at me as we walked out and saying, now that was coaching. And that's a moment you can't see, you can't report unless you have that kind of access that I had. And it did show that other side of Knight and showed, because the question people always ask about Bob Knight is why did the players put up with it? Why did they deal with it? And that moment was one of the answers.
He lost his job finally when he, shoved a player?
No, actually, it was two things. It was a buildup of things. But the last two straws were he was accused of having grabbed a player, a former player named Neil Reed, by the neck. He denied it. One of his former assistants who he'd had a dispute with actually had a practice tape showing Knight grabbing Neil Reed by the neck. He released it. It was seen. Knight was given, quote-unquote, zero tolerance by the school president, the late Miles Brand at the time. And then a few months later, when an Indiana student was walking by him somewhere, and the kid said, hey, Knight, what's up? And I know from personal experience that it drives Bob Knight crazy to be referred to as Knight. He wants to be called Coach. And when the kid said, hey, Knight, what's up? Knight turned around and grabbed him by the shirt and pushed him up against the wall and said, you show respect for me. You call me Coach Knight. And that turned out to be, with zero tolerance because of past incidents, the last straw, and he was fired at Indiana.
So the bottom line on Bobby Knight, reading your story and many others about him, it's hard not to characterize his conduct as abusive to a lot of people, mm-hmm. including his players. He obviously also got results. He won a lot of games. Where does he stand? Is this conduct that should be tolerated? Is it really character building, or does he deserve to the disgrace that ultimately befell him?
It's a great question, and it's one that I've wrestled with, honestly, for 25 years. In the conclusion of Season on the Brink, I told a story about Dave Kindred, who was a mentor of mine and a friend of Knight's, writing a column about another Knight incident. I don't even remember which one, but he, at the end of the column, Dave said, and once again, the question is raised with Bob Knight, does the end justify the means? And Knight called him and said, you should have added one more line, and said, the answer is, yes, it does. And in the book, in Season on the Brink, I said that I agreed with that statement, that the end did justify the means, because Knight did touch many lives in a positive way. 25 years later, I'm not sure I feel that way. And it's not just because of the way he treated players, but because of the way he treated people like Mike Krzyzewski, who he didn't speak to for 9 years because Krzyzewski had the nerve to beat him in a Final Four game. And then he didn't speak to Steve Alford, who was the star player on the team when I was writing Season on the Brink, for a number of years for more perceived slights. I just have trouble with the way he treats not his enemies but his friends. And one of his ex-coaches said to him one time, you know, coach, your biggest problem is you treat your enemies better than you treat your friends. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, sadly, for Bob Knight.
You've written a lot about golf, some great stuff. And I have to ask you about Tiger Woods, who, you know, was just such an incredible talent when he arrived. I mean, he dominated his sport in a way that is rare in athletics. What was he like when you first got to know him on the tour?
You know, I don't think anybody who does what I do has ever really known Tiger. I do vividly remember the first time I ever saw Tiger Woods, because it turned out to be a little bit of a harbinger in a way. He was still an amateur. He was just a kid. He was 18. He probably looked 12 at the time. He was playing in Arnold Palmer's tournament down at Bay Hill in 1994, and I was working on A Good Walk Spoiled, my first golf book, and I was standing on the range with three players, Davis Love, Billy Andrade, Jeff Sluman. And Billy Andrade kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, see that kid down there? And I looked down and there was this skinny kid hitting balls. And I said, yeah? And he said, that's the next one. That's Tiger Woods. And I'd heard the name. But I wasn't that interested, to be honest, Dave, because you hear all the time about this guy's the next one in sports. This guy's the next one in sports. I always tend to be skeptical and say, okay, show me. And as luck would have it, I happened to walk off the range a little while later, about 10 yards behind Tiger Woods. He was walking alone with his caddy, and there were maybe 15 or 20 kids standing behind the ropes trying to get the autographs of any player walking on or off the range. It was a practice day, and most players will stop in that circumstance and sign a few autographs. Tiger Woods put his head down and walked right between the kids, never looked left or right, and just kept going. And I remember thinking to myself, who does this guy think he is? Well, as it turned out, he thought he was Tiger Woods. So I think he had it right. But my early memories of Tiger are that he was always programmed. And his golf was overwhelming. But I remember feeling disappointed because he was obviously very bright. He'd gone to Stanford for a couple of years. You could tell just by the way he reacted to things that he got things quicker than most athletes did. But he wasn't giving anything up. His father, Earl, had programmed him, don't give away anything for free. And if you tried to talk to him one-on-one, he really had no interest. And the only time I really ever had a lengthy one-on-one conversation with him was in 1998, after he'd won the Masters and had become a superstar at 21. And he actually reached out to me because he was, I think, surprised, I guess, that I was one of the very few members of the media who was at all critical of his behavior. None of us could criticize his golf. And other players had told him, look, John's a pretty fair guy. If you've got a problem with him, you should sit down and talk to him about it. And to his everlasting credit, he did. We went to dinner at a restaurant in San Diego and talked for about 4 hours. And it was very intense because Tiger was very smart, came right at you. When he disagreed with you, we argued a lot about his father.
And one of the things you'd written about his father was that his father was, you know, the kind of a manipulative sports dad.
Classic stage father.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, what I had done was I had compared him in a piece I'd written in Newsweek to Stefano Capriati, who was the father of Jennifer Capriati, who you might remember years ago came on the tennis tour, took it by storm. She was going to be the next Chris Evert. Her father was making deals for her left and right when she was 13 years old. And I compared Earl Woods to Stefano Capriati, which infuriated both Tiger and Earl. And I remember saying to him, if your father doesn't like the spotlight, why did he write a book about how he made you into Tiger Woods? And Tiger said, well, you know, so many people asked him about it, he thought it'd be easier just to write a book. And I said, really? Then why did he write the second book? Because there was a sequel. Tiger looked at me and he smiled. He said, okay, you got me on that one. But it was one of the few concessions he made the entire evening. We argued about a lot of different things, but it was a fascinating experience. And I hoped that it would sort of be a jumping off point where Tiger and I would have a relationship where even if we disagreed, we would talk about it. And it lasted for a little while. that way. And then I really believe to this day that his father said to him, you stay away from him. I don't like him. I don't want you talking to him. And that was really kind of the end of any one-on-one other than hi, Tiger, hi, John, between the two of us.
You have some great stories in here about tennis. And one of them I like was when you followed John McEnroe into the locker room at the U.S. Open because he wasn't talking to anybody. And this was an example of you just getting access that other people couldn't get and it paying off. Tell us what happened.
Well, more accurately, I think it was that I knew back in those days that I could go into the locker room. And because Barry Lorge, my colleague from The Washington Post, was writing a lead and I was doing the secondary story, the sidebar, I had a little more time. And John had come in. He just won the U.S. Open. He'd beaten Bjorn Borg in five sets. This was a few months after their historic five-set match at Wimbledon. And Borg had come back from two sets down to tie it at two sets apiece. And I'll never forget sitting there in New York City. John McEnroe grew up less than 5 miles from the stadium in Flushing. And the entire crowd was on its feet cheering for Borg. And I couldn't imagine what that felt like for McEnroe. And he somehow won the fifth set, came in, gave kind of a desultory press conference. Even McEnroe can be desultory in a press conference. And I thought, well, maybe if I go back to the locker room, I can get something. I just wanted to ask him one question. How did that feel at that moment at the end of the fourth set when 20,000 people were cheering for a guy from Sweden in New York City? And I walked back in, and McEnroe was the only guy in the locker room because the tournament was over. Borg had left by car as soon as the award ceremony was over. And it was just McEnroe and me in the locker room. At that point, I hadn't met him. I was very young, you know, the kid reporter at the Washington Post. And I introduced myself, and John kind of looked at me like, yeah. And I said, I just want to ask you one question. And I asked him the question about how it felt at the end of that fourth set. And Dave, he just went off. He said, could you believe that? Do you think if that match was in Sweden, there'd be one person pulling for me? He said, I know I misbehave, and I understand why people get up. I didn't ask another question for 30 minutes. To me, a lot of times people have asked me, well, how did you get Knight to give you the access? How did you get this guy to give you the access? The answer almost always is because I asked. It's really that simple.
You know, McEnroe was such a controversial player. He seems like such a sometimes funny and engaging guy in his current public persona. Why was he so unable to control himself on the court?
I'm sure he's asked himself that question a million times. I remember at the end of his career, I asked him at one point, I said, do you have any regrets? And he said, yeah, you know, I wish I hadn't spent all that time arguing with umpires. I shouldn't have done it. I know I hurt myself. And I said, yeah, and you know, most of the time they had the calls right. And he said, no, they didn't. They were always wrong. I just shouldn't have wasted all my energy arguing with them. And that's kind of John. I mean, in a sense, he gets it. He knows that he shouldn't have done what he did, but there's a part of him that just can't help himself.
You've seen so many sports up close, and you know, millions of people watch these games on television where it kind of looks, well, if not easy, not like it does when you're at ground level, really seeing how incredibly fast, you know, these guys are and how incredibly agile and talented they are. Do you often sit there and just think people have no idea what this is about?
I do. It's funny because one of the most frightening things you can do, and I mean that literally, is stand on the sideline at a college football or a professional football game because the speed of the game is so incredible that every time there's what looks like on television, a routine play, running back takes the ball, goes in the hole, linebacker tackles him, everybody gets up and goes back to the huddle. If you're standing there on the sideline, you can't believe that either guy got up because the collision takes place at such high speed and with such force. And the level that these guys and women are at is so different than that of, you know, your good garden variety weekend athlete.
One more thing. You know, I've noticed in my career writing mostly about things other than sports that when I occasionally have done a story at a newspaper that dealt with sports, like I did a piece once about Philadelphia Eagles tickets and whether they were distributed fairly, and I got many, many times the email that I did when I did something about the mayor. And it's clear that sports, you know, is something that people are really, really passionate about. But I also wonder, are there times that you want to just tell people, folks, these are games. This is not life and death.
Absolutely, yes. But there's an element of no. And the absolute yes is, of course, they're just games. And it's not life and death. And I wince every time there's a genuine tragedy connected to sports when people say, well, this puts life in perspective. Because you know what? It doesn't. The next day, fans are going to be screaming about a losing coach or a bad call or something like that. It's human nature. It's sports human nature. And I want to say enough already. But there's another part of me, Dave, that believes sports does play a very important role in our society because it does give people a place to go away from the often harsh realities of life. And I this was driven home to me in a very personal way when my mother died in 1993. And she died very suddenly and she died young. And it was the worst thing I've ever been through in my life. And I went to bed every night and I couldn't sleep. I just couldn't possibly sleep. And the only thing that distracted me from thinking about my mom was to think about games, to think about games I'd played in as a kid or swim meets I'd been in as a kid and games I'd covered and stories I'd been a part of and people I'd met in sports and trying. I would literally sit there and try to remember every single play in Game 5 of the 1969 World Series when my beloved and now pathetic Mets beat the Baltimore Orioles. And that got me through that period in my life.
Well, John Feinstein, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Dave, thanks for having me again. I enjoyed it.
John Feinstein's new book is called One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats in the Game. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.